Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, hey, everybody. It is Tuesday. I think it's, what's March something or other? This is Richard Kramer. This is my podcast, which as of yet has no name, but I'm, I think I'm going to call it A Streetcar Named Desire for this week, and which is always a title that I love. And I have with me part two of an interview that we started last week, and it was so much fun, and we had much more that we wanted to say that we decided to give you guys part two. My guest, my lovely guest, is Rachel Schuchert, who has just written a novel. It's her third book, but it's her first novel, and it is called Starstruck. It was published, I think, Rachel, was it last week? Officially?
Yeah.
Amazing. It published last week by Random House. It is, they're describing it as a YA, but I personally think, having read it and loved it, that it has a much broader application than that, although that's a pretty good application. But I think anybody could like this, you know, this book. It's wonderful. It's about three girls, three teenage girls in Hollywood in the 30s. And I want to just say a couple of things about you, Rich. I hope this doesn't embarrass you before we get into this. First
it
of
may
all,
be. At least no one can see me.
Nobody can see you. But
no one can see me fetal with shame.
We are speaking from different coasts, which is still remarkable to me. Rachel's in New York, in Stuyvesant Oval in New York City. And I am in Los Angeles in West Hollywood. And we have many things to say to each other. But I got to know Rachel first from Facebook, which I always thought I would hate, but I like because I've met people like Rachel on it, and she is my favorite person that I've met. And she had become famous for her – she was famous before, but she became – when I came across her, she was famous for doing her Smash recaps over the TV show Smash that were on the New York Magazine Vulture site, which is actually my favorite show business site.
Oh, mine too.
Isn't it wonderful? I think it's just great.
Yeah.
They do a great job.
They do.
And
I like the Entertainment Weekly one too, but Vulture is great.
Vulture is fantastic, and it's a great place for you. And these recaps, you know, Smash was the show that was theoretically, or not even theoretically, about Broadway. Interestingly, I've never told you this, Rachel, but I had gone to Showtime when Bob Greenblatt, who is now the head of NBC, was there with the same idea that we were going to do with James Lapine.
Oh, my God. That would have been amazing.
And the thing that we were going to do was we were going to get real people, like, you know, from the musical theater program at NYU, if that still exists, or wherever,
yeah,
and have them write a show for us. So we weren't going to do it through fictional characters. But we were going to mix the fictional characters, you know, of the director, the choreographer, the producer, with the real people who were writing a show, and we were going to put the show up. We were going to follow the show as it developed.
Uh-huh. I see. So it's sort of like a half reality show, half kind of scripted show.
Yeah, it was supposed to be, you know,
yeah.
I thought it was fun.
Just sort of what Smash has become in certain ways.
Yeah, basically, except it bears no resemblance to reality. And not to keep knocking it, because just to jump off from my idea that didn't happen, what is wonderful about your Smash recaps is they're not mean-spirited. And they are not at all. And
yeah,
they are what I always feel when I read them is that I feel how much you want it to be good. I really feel like you're rooting for it. And I feel like it always disappoints you.
Yeah.
So there's a tragic
that's
quality
sort of
to
good.
It.
Yeah, that's a sort of good way of describing it.
But it's not,
like
it's not bitchy. It's not bitchy. It's not, you know, it's not.
I feel like it mirrors my own career to an extent.
In a way, it's really interesting. In some funny way, I mean, I hope somebody, you know, that when you're done, when the show is finally, you know, not on the air anymore, that somebody will have the brains to put it together in some way as a small book. Because has anybody brought that up?
I have sort of a meeting about it with, I don't know how much I should talk about it, but yeah, people have brought it up, and I think it probably depends on rights and things like that, but I hope that that will happen. I really wanted to do it like as a sort of printed lovely thing that could have like drawings in it and things. I wanted it to be illustrated.
But, you know, the funny thing is like, this gave me an idea just talking about this, is that it would be maybe my next novel, because we're going to talk about my novel today, too, my novel These Things Happen, published last November by Unbridled Books, and that Rachel and I have spent a lot of time talking about. Wouldn't it be interesting to do a whole novel that the whole story is expressed in recaps?
That would be amazing. Like, it's
you know,
describing
keeps
things that happened.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a weekly thing, somebody recapping their own, you know, life.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's a little bit what, like, novels that are written. I mean, it's like a modernized way of doing a sort of epistolary novel, right? Or like a diary novel.
Yeah,
you know,
because,
I mean,
you know, people are trying to do it, like, you know, with Twitter, you know, with tweets. And,
oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, and text.
Twitter's too hard. You're too limited.
Well, it's just too limited, you know?
Yeah.
But really what I think I'm saying here is that, you know, you have made of the recap its own kind of form. And people have been doing them for a while now, but there's something about that what you bring to it, which is basically it just hit me what it is. That everybody who does recaps is not also a writer and an artist. They are people who do recaps.
Yeah.
Who are snarky, you know, who are superior to what they're writing about. And you are, quite independently from your recaps, a genuine writer. You're a novelist, you know, you're a playwright, and you're an artist. And so you come at it in a way that makes it an experience that's just bigger than some stupid recap.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I kind of think that my recaps wound up being the way that they were because I don't know that I do it better or anything than anybody else, but I do think that mine is maybe one of the only recaps, if not the only recap, where the person that's recapping is also sort of part of the world that's being depicted in the show.
Yes,
so it wasn't,
you know,
like it's coming
world
from like this sort of outsider. You know, like I know a lot of the people that are on the show, or I've gotten to know them, or I know the people that turn up in cameos, and I was a playwright, and I really know the world, and I'm also like a little bit a part of the world, you know, at least on a sort of in an outskirty kind of way, which someone who's recapping a show about spies, you know, is probably not. So
yeah, exactly.
I think that, yeah. So I feel like there was a certain kind of insiderness that also made people that were in the world and on the show kind of able to accept it because it wasn't coming from some, like it's coming from one of us, you know? And I think that that kind of definitely informed my recap just in the sort of aesthetic of it and the things that I'm able to reference and that sort of a thing. But I think it also made people sort of able to relate to it in a different way, that it felt like it was this interior, internal kind of in-joke to an extent, which I think that also people that were outside of the in-joke responded to because it feels like, I don't know, it feels different. It's not, you're right, it's not snarky that way.
Well, you know, it's so funny. You know, everything you say I agree with. And, you know, one of the ways that the show has really been challenged, I mean, first of all, let me say this is a show that I so want to be good so want to see do sort of hit it. But one of the things the show has had such a hard time accomplishing is a sense of authenticity about the world. It doesn't feel like it's made by people who know the theater or love the theater. And that's so odd because it's made by a lot of people who know the theater
who
and
really
love the theater.
The theater and are part of the theater. I mean, I think I put some of it down to just the sort of vagaries of being on network television where there are, I don't know, you would know better than me having worked in network television, but just this, the way that sort of characters have to be kind of telegraphed, and theater people are very complicated, you know? And I think that you just don't have, like, enough time with the show or enough time with the characters to kind of let them be as, like, weird as actual theater, because I feel like that kind of need to be, like, instantly likable or instantly understandable is just not what people that work in the theater are about.
Yeah,
I mean?
that's very interesting. You know, one other thing, though, you know, I mean, having done a lot of television shows, I have to, you know, say it's really hard to do a television show. It's hard to do a television show even badly.
Yeah. Oh,
and
yeah, absolutely.
It's really, really hard. And it is, you know, and I feel for them, because with everybody sort of, you know, eyeballing it so closely and saying it's not this, it's not that. I'm not implying that your recaps do that, but it must be a nightmare to be there.
I mean, I feel like it must be like working in Congress or something, like having like really good intentions and being like a member of the House of Representatives.
Yeah, exactly.
Everyone's like, why are you not pushing for this? This is like completely impossible.
But anyway, you know, that's, you know, how I was fortunate enough to get to know you and your work. And then I was, you know, lucky again to get to know you personally. And so you're like my perfect first and second guest, and you can even be my third guest if you want to. But, you know, our two books, we have these two books that they share this interesting, odd sort of approach, which is, you're someone who's lived in New York since you were, what, 18?
Yeah, 17, 8, something like that, yeah.
When you went to, you know, to the Tisch School at NYU,
yes,
which is the great, great acting school, to study as an actress. And you've written your first novel is about life on the other side of the country and also in another
period.
Yes,
where I've never lived.
Yeah, it's so interesting.
Yeah.
And my book, and I've lived in L.A. since, you know, for 35 years, if you can believe it. Is about New York, and it's about a world that I don't really know.
Yeah, well, it's kind of about, I mean, the thing that I love about your book is how perfectly it captures this, like, mythical New York that everyone wants to be a part of, where everyone is sort of fascinating and smart and neurotic in a lovable way and doing something very interesting and has this kind of finger on the pulse of, like, what is, like, very kind of Upper West Side-y and cultural. And I mean, I remember reading your book and feeling so envious of, like, Wesley and Theo, that, like, these were their parents and this was the world that they grew up in.
Well,
you know,
let me
it's like
just,
all
just
that I ever
you,
wanted.
Growing up in Omaha, Nebraska, my book, I'll just give you a very quick précis of it, it's about many characters, but the two characters who Rachel just referred to, audience out there, are these two teenage boys who are not named Holden Caulfield, but are named Wesley and Theo, who are, you know, these you know, bright, you know, interesting New York kids who have very progressive parents who want them to be brilliant and who want them to be cultured and who want them to be, you know, remarkable. And the thing I was going to say about my New York, though, is, like, you know, I grew up in New York, which was like I thank my parents for that all the time. But I also didn't grow up in the city. I grew up just outside the city. So the city was romantic to me, but it also felt like home.
Uh-huh.
And the New York that I wrote about in the book, many people have told me, and I'm so happy about this, is that they thought it really captured New York now. And I kept wanting to say, well, I haven't lived there since 1977.
Right.
But it's a New York that's in a way, it's like Holly-Golightly's New York. You know, it's like, you know, it's the New York of my dreams, which is not real.
Right.
But it was so much fun to bring it back. And it, what it did for me, I want to ask you the same question about yours, too, is I have been boring people for 35 years with how much I hate Los Angeles, how great New York is, and how much I want to move back, and should I move back.
Oh, well, I've told you my maxim, right, that I invented. I'm saying this because it sounds like something that someone else said, and I want everyone to know that I made it up.
Oh, good.
Which is that that New York is full of happy people pretending to be miserable, and L.A. is full of miserable people pretending to be happy.
That's perfect. You can have that one. That's yours. You should copy or you should register that with the Writers Guild, East and West.
Yeah, because it's how I've always sort of felt, that everyone in New York kind of loves their life, but they have to constantly complain about it and tell you how badly they're doing. And how, I mean, it's like very Jewish, you know. It's like that, how are you? Like, oh, don't ask. That kind of a thing. And then I go to LA and I meet these people that I know just feel like horrible failures, and they're constantly like smiling and talking about how great their gluten-free diet is and you know, how they just got like a call back for something and they really think things are changing. It's like this sort of thinly veiled frenzy behind all this like sort of shiny, smiling health food happiness.
The Chinese thing is, you know, during the cultural, you know this, during the Cultural Revolution, that they would put them in work camps and make them smile all day. That was a punishment. To improve their terrible attitudes. To improve their terrible attitudes. And, you know, and I keep thinking, you know, if I was put into a Chinese work camp, they would pick my terrible attitude and just, like, make me smile all day for years.
That's like your 1984 terrible thing. Like,
yes.
Like if they could give
constant
you like the
smiling.
Most awful thing, smiling.
Constant smiling. Now, are you hearing? Is your end? Is it breaking up a little bit?
It is. Yeah.
I wonder if that's affecting the our transmission.
It's possible. But, is there something we can do about it?
I don't know. I think we just probably have to keep talking.
Okay, we'll just try to enunciate.
And, you know, we'll remember everything we said, so if it didn't work out, we can do it again. But
yeah, yeah.
I wanted to ask you, you know, a question about what made you – first of all, I just want to say I just read the best interview with you, like, that has asked every question that I would ever want to ask, and you did the most terrific answers, which
oh,
is one
thanks.
Of the
Frisky one? Yeah.
What is that? It's so good.
It's like a – it's a great website. It's sort of like a – it's sort of like a cool women's kind of internet website. It's all things – you know, sort of the way that I think that people have begun to put sort of like more modern women's magazines on the internet. So it's all, you know, celebrity news and fashion and kind of bloggy in a fun way.
It's sort of like that Tabby girl, huh?
Yeah, yeah, a bit like that, but a little bit older. There was at some point, I think, that the idea there, I think it's part of the same media group as The Gloss, and the idea is that The Gloss is sort of for like more like teenagers and women in their early 20s, and the Frisky skews like a little bit older.
Well, I just, you know, I thought she asked you great questions, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, she's great. Julie Gerstein, who wrote it, is a really great journalist.
I want to put our listeners, you know, onto that too, frisky.com, and it appeared today.
Yeah,
I got the link.
Frisky.com.
I got the link from Facebook. Excellent, excellent interview. But talk about some of this stuff, but I wanted to just get it from you from your, you know, another angle, which is what made you, you know, want to write? This is not an attacking question because I hate those, like when somebody asks an author. Well, one just very tangentially, one thing that I have really seen from people who have been negative about my book, which thank God aren't all that many people, they always say, why didn't you do this?
Yes,
you know,
it's that critical voice.
Critical voice, but it's like, why didn't you write the book I wanted you to write?
Right.
And there's no answer to that. And you know, I was at some event, and people asked me some questions about, you know, in this part of it, why did you not do that? And I just said, because it never occurred to me.
Right, exactly. Because there's no, I mean, it's like, why didn't your parents name you something that I like better? I mean, it's just it's like really... It's a really strange question, but it is something that I feel people ask because there's this kind of, I don't know, I feel like the internet has really opened up criticism in a way that is incredibly great, but is also sometimes makes people ask the wrong questions, I think.
Well, I think it's taken down some of the mystique between creator and consumer.
Yes, right, exactly.
And,
has
made it so personal.
Right, and we live in this sort of era of personal choice and customization where people can choose every playlist that they want to listen to on the radio and exactly what you want to watch at exactly what time. Like, it's all about these specifications. So I feel like that sometimes bleeds over into work that doesn't work that way.
And so I was, you know, every time somebody asked me, why didn't you do this, I just literally thought to myself, before I even said it, I said, it never would have occurred to me.
Right.
And one of the things I loved about writing a book and about writing this book, which is my first novel, is that after years as a screenwriter and as a television writer, there is no such thing as why didn't you do this, because everybody has an opinion before you write it.
Right.
And you are writing, you know, I always said it's like, you know, you're a decorator and they give you the swatches and just tell
right.
you to go out and pick up the material.
Right.
You know, and you think that that's a great way of life. And, you know, until I wrote a book and nobody was doing that, I realized, wow, I think I prefer this.
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, I think, I feel like I maybe it's good to have some balance, because I sometimes feel like I'm at a point where I sometimes wish someone would, I would have like another collaborative voice in the room once in a while.
Well, you haven't had that particularly.
I haven't had that. No, not really, you know, for any protracted period of time. So I think that there must be a happy medium. But I know what you mean. It's that sort of sense that you don't have to answer to anybody and it's just all you. But that can also be, I think, part of the scary thing about writing a book. I mean, I remember, you know, I began my career as a playwright and you have the opening night and you sort of wait for the reviews to come out and everyone's nervous. But there's a sense that you're all sort of in it together, and if something is bad or if the response is bad, it's not like totally your fault. Like it's sort of also, it's shared among all these other people. And so is the praise, obviously. But it's a little bit more spread out. And so I feel like it feels like you've got buddies, like you have people that have your back in a way that in writing a book it never feels like.
Well, you know, you talk about a balance and a happy medium. You know, when I wrote the book, this is a perfect example of what I had been trained to do from my other, you know, writing life. I wrote the book and my editor had almost no comments, except
uh-huh.
a couple of questions that he wanted me to answer. And I took it upon myself to basically go off for 3 months and tighten the book, because I was
interesting.
And no one asked me to do it. And I was so, I thought I was being such a professional and so this and such a writer. And I tightened and tightened and tightened and I sent it to him and I just thought, well, we've really got something now. And he called me up and he said, I don't know what the fuck you've done. He said, you've ruined your own book.
Yeah, because books don't have to be tightened.
That's what he said. He said books
yeah.
should be baggy and roomy.
Yeah, that's great. That's such good advice.
And he said, your book has lost its charm, and it's lost its voice. It sounds corporate.
Huh.
And we went back to the draft that he bought in manuscript,
mm-hmm.
and I changed two little sentences. And that was such an amazing thing for me to see, because I've been writing scripts for decades.
Right.
And you learn how to be so terse, because you think that's good screenwriting. It isn't necessarily, but you think that it is. And I developed skills.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like you have to have all these tricks to sort of, like, make it palatable to other people, you know, who, like, because, I mean, I remember when you gave me all that wonderful advice about this sort of TV script that I wrote, sort of like paring down all these descriptive things because people will just stop reading, you know. So I think, you know, you kind of, maybe it's true in screenwriting and more than it is in books, but do you feel this way that like you have to kind of proof it for the people that you know are going to read it to kind of get through these obstacles first?
I do. And I mean, I'm talking as somebody who was incredibly lucky with the people that I worked with, because, you know, the bulk of my work in television was done with my friends of 35 years, Ed Zwick and Marshall Herskovitz, who only wanted me and us, you know, the other people who worked with them, to be ourselves. And if we tried to make it sound like them, they would get mad.
Uh-huh.
And that's almost unheard of. But, you know, the results were shows that people remember for their voices, you know, like My So-Called Life and 30-something and Once and Again. And the miracle of that was that we all had very distinctive voices. And so, you know, I was a little bit spoiled, but I've also had plenty of horrible experiences like anybody does. And,
right.
you know, when you talk about making it palatable, I mean, you know, so many people have internalized, it's like almost like, you know, living in an abusive household. I mean, you become, you know, hyper aware
right.
and hyper vigilant, I think is the term, that
you want
to make it so there's nothing they can criticize.
Right.
And that,
and of course you can't. There's always
something you can't. You just can't. And the, you know, I was going to, you know, one of the things I wanted to ask you in reading Starstruck, and also this is partly from talking to you, but, you know, did you feel that in some way that writing that book in some way was like your first step to buying a ticket to leaving New York and coming to LA?
Well, I think it was the first time that I had really in my head sort of romanticized a place other than New York. I mean, you talk about, and you certainly did this in your book, and you talk about how the city is kind of romantic, and I think that it has that pull for so many people. And that was something that I definitely felt as a kid. I mean, I never fantasized about living in L.A., at least not the L.A. that I had sort of spent any time in you know, my contemporary time. I went to LA to like visit like cousins that lived in the valley in like 1987, and you know, we went to Disneyland. Like, I didn't have any experience of LA, the city, that you would, you know, in a sort of not even just a business sense, but like in really that kind of Hollywood sense. I mean, you'd go and it just felt like you were in any suburb. So I didn't really have any kind of like tangible or like visceral feelings about LA. Until I sort of started to go there, you know, for meetings and, you know, there, my last book, my memoir, there was like a little bit of sort of film interest. So I started going out there for meetings and kind of discovering this other side of Los Angeles that wasn't just sort of, you know, it's just like whoever, but they have a pool in the backyard. And I think that that was the first time that it sort of started to click for me as like a place where people lived and that they made work and that there was things there. And it was very different from New York, but it had its own kind of charm. And then, of course, you know, at the same time, I remember, like, literally thinking, it's so great that I am having to drive around L.A. by myself for the first time because now I know where the streets are and I can use that in the book. You know,
oh,
like,
that's
things
so funny.
That, like, I didn't know at all. Like you know, like, I'd never heard of, like, Highland or
oh, that's,
anything like
that's
that.
So, yeah, you
yeah.
have to, you know, when I was finishing These Things Happen, I mean, even though I grew up in New York, I came and I lived in Brooklyn for 3 months. As I was finishing the first draft, because I said, it's been so long since I have been in New York where I haven't been here for a week and have to see every show and see every friend and go to every museum. So that's not how New Yorkers live.
Right, exactly. No, you just sort of live there. I mean, I think that the really kind of like week that changed it all for me in writing Starstruck, I don't remember. I think I may have been working on the book a little bit already, but I hadn't really. Maybe I'd started writing at the first one, and my husband had to go to Los Angeles for a week for business, and it was like the summer, and he said, you know, why don't you come with, I'm going with my boss, who is sort of a good friend of both of ours, and she's bringing her daughter, and, you know, we're going to stay at the Chateau Marmont, and, like, they're putting us up, and, like, you should just come, like, just, we'll buy you a ticket and come. And that was the first time that I felt like I ever sort of stayed in LA and had this kind of, like, Hollywood experience in this sort of classic hotel, like having like drinks by the pool and seeing like screenwriters working in the lobby and things like that, you know? And the fact that like it's this hotel that has been there forever, obviously, and that the characters that were formulating, that I was formulating in my head, you know, would have been there and it wouldn't have looked that different. That was like a really kind of, that was when I really felt like I was in this sort of like immersion program. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
This sort of portal. And that was when things sort of started to really come together for me. That was like a sort of turning point about Los Angeles. And I, you know, I like LA. I haven't lived there, but I have to say I definitely see why people like it. And maybe it did prepare me for the idea of moving. I mean, I've been in New York for a long time, and on some level I feel like, you know, it wouldn't be a terrible thing to have a change. But also just, I think, really sort of getting to know another city is exciting. And as a New Yorker, it's a hard thing to let yourself do, because New Yorkers are so invested in the idea that there's no other city but New York, and it's the best place on earth, and it's the only place that could live or feel comfortable. And a lot of that is because you have to really be delusional in order to like go through the stuff that you have to do to live here, you know, to be like, no, it's totally worth it to pay $4,000 a month for this room, you know. Like, it's totally worth it to like have no car and no anything, and everything is inconvenient and everything's a hassle, and it's always like, you know, I'm always exhausted and it's noisy. Like, you have to sort of buy into this. It's almost like being in a cult. So
yeah.
Letting go
yeah.
of that a little bit was really interesting for me.
Well, you know, here's a, you know, I'm going to do a little experiment here, which is that, you know, these are theoretically supposed to be half an hour. We're coming up to that, but I'm happy to just talk on for a bit more. Are you?
Yeah, sure.
Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to say, for official reasons, this is the wrap-up of Richard Kramer's podcast for this week with my guest, Rachel Schuchert, the author of the just-published by Random House novel Starstruck, which you all must rush out and buy for your, you know, for your hands or for your Kindle. But we're going to keep talking just in case that's kosher to do, because I don't know that it's not. But if it's not, you know, this should be a satisfying half hour, and we're going to keep talking if you want to keep listening.
Yeah.
So that has been stated.
Okay, perfect. That's been stated. So, Richard, I want to know a little bit why you chose to write about New York. I mean, was it a sort of sense of wanting to relive a place that you've been? I mean, you write specifically about the theater, too, and I realize that I don't know anything about your background in the theater.
I don't have one.
Really?
Yeah, I don't have one.
You would have been a playwright or something.
I don't really have one, except I grew up going to the theater and being completely fascinated by it and obsessed by it. But when I went to college, I didn't, study, theater or drama or anything like that. I was an English major because I wanted to be a novelist. And, and also, I'm 60, but
that makes it sound like you're older than 60, which I know that you're not.
I know I'm not older than 60, but I am 60. And when I grew up as a, quote unquote, gay boy, it was not
right.
safe to say what you were interested in.
Uh-huh.
And I grew up in a very sort of standard American, basically kind of butch household, where my interest in the theater was not going to help me at all. And
right.
that was made very, very clear. And I was not, except, it was okay with my mother, but it was not okay with my dad, who is a very lovely person who is 93, who is, a terrific guy with whom I have a wonderful relationship. But he simply did not know how to handle a boy who wanted to go see musicals at age 8.
Right.
And there was just no template for that. And so I just sort of tucked all that away, and I think it brewed in me and came out in this book.
Huh.
Because,
that's so interesting.
The main character in this book is somebody who was a performer.
And
yes. I never was. Because I'm since I wrote the book, I'm discovering as I go out and do readings and stuff like that I love performing.
Yeah.
And
well, you're a very good talker in front of groups. I've seen you. Very articulate and very engaging and very comfortable.
And you haven't heard me do my funny stuff because I now open with like 10 minutes of material.
And you have an act.
I have an act. And I do a ballad, and I do a comedy song. I mean, basically, I've developed a persona to go out there and work with.
Right.
And,
well, you have to a little bit.
You have to. Yeah, you have. It's one of the things that I learned. I mean, that's the substance of a whole podcast is who you need to become once the book is published.
I had this whole idea of this class I wanted to teach at the New School of teaching authors how to read their own work aloud so it was engaging. Because
yes.
I don't know how many times you go see someone read and they convince you not to buy a book that you were already interested in because you can't, because there's so many people that just don't know how to read aloud and have you be able to follow it.
That's a great idea.
Able to just, and I'm not talking about doing voices and being an actor, but just being able to sort of connect the thoughts the way that you would if you were speaking to somebody.
Well, there's also that basic acting thing that I use, I have training as an actor, which I actually got once I came out here and was already working in television and screenwriting.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I studied for 3 years.
What techniques did you study?
I studied with some of the great people. I studied with Stella Adler.
Wow, really?
With her. With
I had
her.
No idea.
Oh yeah, this
oh
is why
God.
This is the thing that helped me write for actors comfortably. I studied with Stella Adler. I mean, this was in the early 80s, and
that's
she
amazing.
Was very much alive. And
it wasn't
she was
her corpse.
Yeah, well, I was just, you know, yeah, I would, you know, exactly. She was formidable, really mean and mean-spirited and bitter. But and she would wear a gown. She was
like
walking
an
with
evening
a cane.
Gown?
An evening gown. And all this jewelry, and she would basically be sort of led on by this sort of, you know, bodybuilder. And she would sit on the stage on this on this throne that was raised on a little, you know, platform. And the actors, you know, who would do scenes would do them right in front of her, where she was in the scenes, and because it was in this little tiny theater on Santa Monica Boulevard. And she was, you know, weird and also incredibly inspiring.
Right.
Because she would talk about, you know, when she, and it wasn't bullshit either. I mean, she was grand, but she wasn't full of shit. And I don't have any problem with grand if it's based on something.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, and she would talk about, oh, when I went to Russia and studied this with Stanislavski, and she was telling the truth.
Right.
You know, and she would talk about Odets, and she had been married to Harold Clurman, and, you know, and her stories alone, and you know, recently some of her, I'm not sure what the word I'm looking for, it's not transcripts, but the redacted, it is transcripts, of her classes on, like Chekhov and Ibsen, and and she just have been published, and where she talks about, the most recent one is about the great American playwrights, and she says things that nobody else has ever said, because she was coming from a very specific place of knowing them, of knowing the work. I studied with her.
Right.
I studied with Jose Quintero.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I was incredibly lucky, and he was also inspiring. I studied with Nina Foch, who was
the
great
Foch?
Actress. The Nina Foch, yeah.
Nina Foch?
She was a great actress.
An American
teacher.
In Paris? She's in my two favorite movies of all time, An American in Paris and The Ten Commandments.
Oh, well, you know, you're funny. You look at her in those movies now. I mean, you know, and I actually saw An American in Paris in the last couple of months, and she's so subtle in it.
And isn't it weird how she's supposed to be sort of like old and undesirable, and there's no way that we could possibly think that he's interested in her physically.
And she's actually quite beautiful.
So beautiful, and they're like the same age also.
Yes, indeed. But she taught acting at the American Film Institute for many years. And Ed Zwick had gone to the American Film Institute, and he told me, he said, you have to study with Nina. And I did for 3 years, and my monologue that we worked on it for 3 years was, she said, I walked in the door, I did one thing, she said, you know who you are? And I said, who? Said, you're Zooey in Franny and Zooey.
Oh, that's the nicest thing ever.
And she said, we're going to work. She said, I've never had a student who was a Zooey before. And she said, I just think you're a Zooey. And we worked on Zooey, which is, you know, about 25 pages long.
You are a Zooey.
In her class, and I would work with her privately and also in another class. And that was, we broke that down beat by beat by beat.
Oh, my God.
And I could basically
do it.
I haven't done it for so long, but I could basically do it I basically learned it.
Right.
And she
would
sit there, and she would sit there like she was in a, you know, like in a, like she was the director and she was shooting, she would sit 2 feet away from me and have me play it right to her. But so she said to me the most remarkable thing, and it so influenced my writing. She said, acting is reacting to the needs of your partner.
Yeah.
And writers don't know that unless they hear it.
Well, or unless they were actors.
that's exactly what I mean. And so I think that I internalized that from her. And so whenever I was writing, I would think about what's going on with the person who's not talking.
Right.
And how is what the person who is talking saying a response to what the person who's not talking is doing?
Right, yeah.
So it removed it from good writing and made it about interactional writing.
Right.
And I owe that so to her. And I really love, she's unfortunately dead. She lived to be quite old. But she was a real sort of mama figure to a lot of friends of mine and to me. And she was a crazy nut. And she would, you know, say things like, she said, well, you know, I had a major career as a child until the kidnapping. And then she would never say what the kidnapping was. So she was...
Did you ever find out?
No.
The kidnapping.
She replaced Jessica Tandy in Streetcar and went on tour with Anthony Quinn as Stanley. And she was quite amazing, and I loved her. And then my other acting teacher, since you asked, was a guy named Robert Lewis, who was one of the founders of the Actors Studio.
Oh, right, okay.
Who ran the Yale Drama School for many, many, many years, and was a legend. He was also a very successful director on Broadway, and he was, you know, an old man when I worked with him. But he, from him, I learned the whole thing about left-hand pages, which I'm sure you know about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
And, you know, what an actor's script is. And,
yeah.
And all that stuff went into my writing.
Yeah. Well, it's important. I mean, I think it makes it all so much richer. I definitely think that having an acting background is really helpful with writing sort of novelistic characters, because you develop the character in the same way. You know, with an acting role, it's all the stuff that nobody ever sees. It's like the things that you know about this character that nobody else knows. But, you know, with a novel, I found that having learned to sort of develop a character, and I was actually not taught to develop a character that way. I was taught the very opposite way. I started my training at the Atlantic Theater School, which was David Mamet's whole thing, which is the whole thing. There is no character. It's just all about the moment. And I didn't find that very inspiring for myself. I mean, I think it's useful for people because it kind of demystifies things. And if you're somebody who gets really caught up in that, I think it's like helpful, but to me it always felt like it was just this sort of manual, and it kind of took the art away from it. So I would always develop all these like deep histories of characters anyway, because I found that it helped me, you know, to be able to be imaginative, and the way that I do it in a novel is exactly the same way, you know, sort of just thinking about like, what does this person want? What have they always wanted? You know, what are things that happened to them in the past, and how will that make them react in the present? So it's very similar. I mean, have you found that?
Very much so. And I'm forgetting the most significant person who I saw was Uta Hagen. And when I first got out of college, which was in 1974, and lived in New York, I studied with at HB, which was, you know, Hagen Berghoff, Herbert Berghoff was her husband. And the thing I got from her is she said, you always have to know where you're coming from.
Yes.
Literally. You know,
right,
like where
exactly,
you were
literally.
A minute before the scene, that the stage is only an intermediate place.
Yeah, which is very smart.
And there's a thing in my book where I have a whole thing at the end where George is reminiscing about in his mind, you know, or just remembering about when he was an actor and how he always thought of life as being just a series of next places that you would stop here, and then you would go to the next place, and you would go to the next place.
I remember that line.
And in all the time that he did that, he never thought about where was the place that he would settle.
Right.
And, so all
George
this stuff
is such
just swirls around.
George is such an interesting character to me. I mean, George is such an interesting character to me because he's such a, I mean, although this is true actually of a lot of the characters. I mean, he's such a, like, second act character, you know? He's sort of what happens, I think, in that place that feels very scary when you're in the first act of, like, what am I going to do after I'm done doing the thing I always thought I was going to do?
Yes,
exactly. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
And there's still, like, a lot of life to live. Like, I think that most people that are young, and I certainly feel this of myself, your imagination as a child only takes you to, like, a certain age, you know, to, like, a certain place.
and a certain
goal. You think,
goal.
I'm going to be an actor, and I'll be famous, and then it's done. There's no sense of what will happen after that. Even if you achieve that goal, you know, which to some extent it seems like George really did, but that sense of, well, and then what? Because then there's still another, you know, there's a lot of time after that. It's very interesting to me to see people in that place, you know, who have these sort of other lives that at one point they thought was going to be their whole life. I mean, I guess...
You're not there yet in your life, you know, and so, you know, because...
Well, actually, you know, a little I am, because I really did always think that I was going to be an actor. I just feel like I started the second act kind of very early, but there might
maybe
be...
Maybe that's a better way to put it,
yeah. It was a very short first act.
Well, you know, I mean, what you just said is so interesting. Dylan Thomas's widow wrote a biography of him called Leftover Life to Kill, which
uh-huh.
is such a poetic title. And, I mean, he died when he was about 35.
Yeah.
And then, you know, they were supposed to have this great life together, and suddenly she had Leftover Life to Kill.
Right.
And, you know, the thing...
Rose Nyland says something similar in one episode of The Golden Girls that I remember.
Oh, did she really?
She probably got it from that.
without question, you know.
Yeah.
That was the source of so many things. But she, you know, what you said to me, you know, it's funny with George, it's a second act story. And it's funny, when I thought of George first, when I was first writing him, I thought of him at about 35. And then I kept thinking, no, he's closer to my age.
I always thought of him as a bit older than that. Yeah, I thought of him always in, you know, in his 50s, I think.
I think he's 50, 52. And,
yeah.
You know, I think that I was, you know, so many things when you write a book, as I'm sure you know, you're so not aware that you're dealing with.
Oh, completely. And then you only figure it out when people start asking you questions about it later. I mean, I never realized, like, how... I feel like that right now, doing all this sort of press for Starstruck, and of course, since it's a YA novel, people ask you about what you're like as a kid. And then I'm also sort of, you know, having to relate to kids in a way that, you know, I mean, I like kids and I'm not uncomfortable, but you don't normally just, like, talk to teenagers in your day-to-day life unless you have teenagers, which I don't have. So I have felt really like I'm confronting, like, how strange I was as a child and also, like, a lot of things that sort of made me, and realizing, like, how much of this book was this sort of this kind of childhood fantasy of mine. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you didn't know that when you were writing it.
No, I didn't know that when I was writing it. When I was writing it, I mean, I knew I had a good story, and I thought, this is something I'm interested in. I don't think I quite realized how much of a sort of psychological corrective it was for me, you know, and how much of myself was in certain parts of the characters and things like that.
See, that's what makes it compelling for the reader, because, you know, I think you and I have talked about this before, but, you know, I now think one of my, you know, measures for, you know, something is I say, do I feel like the person who made this thing, whatever it is, had to make it?
Yeah, completely. And we've talked about that, yeah. But I know exactly what you mean.
Whether they knew it or not, you know, it's like, you know, it's almost more interesting to me if they don't know why they had to, but they just had to.
Yeah, I think that that's true.
And it's just, you know, I don't mean to knock script writing at all, because I got an enormous amount of pleasure, you know, out of it, and I'll probably do it again without question. And you know, I had it gave me, one of the great things it gave me was a platform from which to discuss the book, because
mm-hmm.
people are very interested in the script writing that I did, thank God. And
well,
I think
that the book tonally is very consistent to the sort of television that you're most known for. I mean, it's sort of very intelligent people having these kind of revelations about themselves. I mean, it's searching, it's interior, it's character. I mean, it's great, but it's, you know, it feels, it's not like you wrote a spy novel or something. No.
I would hate to read my spy novel, because I think they would just become too depressed to ever, you know, finish the job. But the thing that I was thinking about is that, you know, when I say I don't want to knock screenwriting, the difference with screenwriting, one of the differences, you know, it's like, the, you know, now I can go from being boring about the difference between New York and L.A. and the difference to the difference between screenwriting and writing a book. with screenwriting is you do know what you're doing at all times.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, what it is, and it's fine. But writing this book, I never knew what I was doing.
Right.
And the image that I use is in the movie A Clockwork Orange, they do this thing where they torture people by putting their heads in clamps and gluing open their, and like sticking, keeping their eyes sewn open so they would have to keep looking at stuff. That's what I felt like writing the book. And that was the hard part, was having to look at myself.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you have to spend a lot of time alone, which is really hard.
It's really hard. And alone, like looking at yourself in a mirror that shows every flaw that you've got.
Yeah. Yeah, and very particular flaws that are things that you didn't even know that you didn't like about yourself. Like, I've always found when I write things, I'm like, why am I so glib? Why am I...
Me too, I feel that every day.
Yeah,
me too.
Why is everything
it's
so
awful,
fucking clever?
yeah. And you can lose the stuff that's best about what you do when you get like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's there's a wonderful thing. I think we should probably think about wrapping up. I just thought of a great thing to as a closing notion, which is there's a quote that's attributed to Truman Capote. I'm not sure if he ever actually said it, but let's say that he did. He said, the terrible thing about each love affair that you have is that it teaches you something incredibly important, and then the next one you have, it doesn't apply.
Yeah. That's amazing.
And I have a funny feeling that everything that I learned writing these things happen will not apply when I write my next book.
I think that is kind of true. Do you have a next book in mind?
Oh, yes, I do. I've started a next book.
Have you?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm excited.
Yeah, and it's so different from These Things Happen. It couldn't be more different.
Is it a spy novel?
Well, basically. I mean, it's just a very different thing, and it has sort of emerged completely. It's not finished, but I've written about 75 pages of it. And
that's a lot.
I know, and it emerged absolutely without me even thinking that I was looking for another book. And it had to be written, and then it's exactly what I mean. I just said, I have to write this. But it wasn't like I said, what do I have to write? Suddenly I was writing it, and I realized, oh, my God, I have to write this.
That's amazing. That's exciting.
And I'll show you some of it when next I see you. So different. And when I say it's so different, that doesn't mean that I don't love what I just did, because I do love what I just did.
Right.
I
know what you mean, though.
People. Yeah.
I mean, I felt like Starstruck is so different than my last book, which is like a memoir about myself and is really like, you know, sexual and messy. And, you know, I mean, it's very different. But it all comes from you, so it has that's the same. You know,
there's consistency to it, yeah.
Yeah, there's a consistency to the kind of Weltumschung. Like, it's like that, you know? It's like there's these things that are like, everyone has, I think every writer has some sort of like sort of a North Star, like this kind of core principle about what they do. And, you know, whatever you put it in, it kind of is there.
And I think that's also the reason that nobody really knows your work except you.
Yeah.
That you are your own, you know, book section of the New York Times. You are your own this, you are your own that. And so when other people talk to you about your work, or I should say when other people talk to me about my work, I'm often like a little bit at a distance from it.
Yeah.
I just think, I don't feel like they really understand it.
Well,
because they
didn't
live with it.
Well, it's like no one really understands your marriage, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like people can get close and they have their ideas about, like, what you do for each other and why you're together, but, like, no one really knows except the people that are in it. I think it's very similar.
I think that's a great comparison. There's an essential privacy about it that is something that sort of carries you through life.
And the book kind of becomes its own person, too. I mean, do you find that? Like, I feel like you wind up weirdly having this sort of dialogue with this inanimate object where the book kind of tells you things and has its own opinions in some ways. I mean, in that way that you're talking about, like, not knowing what you're doing until much later sometimes, you know, in the way that, like, a partner does. Like, even you don't know the whole story.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny, when the book was published, when it became an actual object and not just a pile of, you know, of printed out pages that were all marked up, I saw it in my local bookstore, which I'm happy to plug, which is Book Soup in Los Angeles. And
I love
there.
Book Soup. Let's
it's
plug
fantastic.
Book Soup.
And it was there 2 weeks before it was anticipated, and I didn't know that it was there, and I was at the cash register, you know, buying something, and I turned around, and there it was. And I literally felt my stomach drop, and every one of my organs reorganized themselves inside me. I said, and I held it up, I said, there's nothing I will not do for you.
It's like having a baby.
It really was.
Yeah.
I said, I now understand. My life from this point on is going to be different.
Yeah.
And I wasn't expecting it. You know, like selling the book, all that stuff, paled in comparison to actually seeing it and holding it.
Yeah. I know. It's really interesting. And I know exactly what you mean, that sort of sense that, like, oh, it's like that. It's just this thing. I think it really is sort of, in a way, I'm sure it's nowhere near as intense, but, like, it's, I think it is a little bit maybe like having a child in that sense. And also in that, I mean, and I've actually found this even more with a novel that, I don't know if I've told you this, how, you know, how when you write a memoir, and all my work sort of previous to this has been published in book form is autobiographical, you know, it's like essays from life or memoirs. And you kind of develop this hard shell, because when people criticize it and they criticize the character, they're criticizing you personally. I mean, they rarely say, like, I don't like the way Rachel wrote about herself. They say, I don't like Rachel, you know? And I know I have a lot of friends who have written sort of similar books to mine who have been very, very wounded by that. And I never was. I always sort of had this, like leathery kind of skin about it, where I'm like, well, that's not me, you know, that's, the character's not supposed to be likable, like, you know, like, I felt like I separated myself from it a little bit more. But I feel so protective of the characters in this book in a way that I've never felt about myself as a character. Like, it's sort of like, you know, like, it's like, you can make fun of your little brother, but no one else can, or, like, you know, it's almost like they're my children, and I feel very worried about them in a way that I never felt when people were sort of publicly criticizing my life choices in, like, very public forums, like the New York Times. It's very strange, because they're someone else. They're their own people, and there's no one to care for them the way that I do. You know, no one loves them unconditionally the way that I do. I feel like that has a lot of people
way.
That love me, and it's fine, you know.
I feel
but
totally
they,
the same way.
It's really weird.
Yeah. I mean, I feel feminine, like we talked about recently, you know, when somebody says, you're just like a woman, it's never meant as a compliment.
Right.
But I feel this sort of female principle in me about the world and the people in the world of my book, which is like this enormous sort of mother thing.
Yeah.
Directly connected to it, you know, by blood and by amniotic fluid and, you know, by backache, you know, and all that stuff,
yeah,
and carrying it. I mean, it's different than how a father feels.
Yeah.
And it's a very, very intense thing, and it just makes me think, you know, like, you know, books are the best thing in the world. The hardest and the best.
Yeah.
So I think we should wrap up on that very apocalyptic note. that Armageddon like note. And it's now 3 o'clock. We've done double duty here. So we actually have, like, you know, two podcasts in one.
Double episode.
And I'm going to just, you know, sign off and say it's been my great pleasure to have Rachel Shuchard, the author of Starstruck, the mind behind the Smash recaps, and a cherished colleague and friend as my guest.
Yes, well, likewise, it's been a pleasure for me. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. And I will sure talk to you soon in one, you know, social media aspect or another, or by phone,
yes,
or hopefully face-to-face.
Yes, I hope so.
Me too.
I think so.
I've loved this conversation.
Me too. It's always
okay,
so great to talk to you. All right,
okay.
I'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hello?